Big Blue Insider is on News Radio 630 WLAP and WLAP.com. Get on the show. Call 280-CATS. That's 280-2287. Or toll free at 1-800-606-GAME. That's 1-800-606-4263. Big Blue Insider is brought to you by UK Healthcare. Now, here's Dick Gabriel.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Big Blue Insider. Dick Gabriel with you. Curtis Birch on the other side of the bulletproof glass tonight. We are here to take your calls at 280-2287, 800-606-4263. You can tweet us at Big Blue Insider 1. And we're kind of all over the place tonight, baseball, football, basketball, you name it. And we'll talk about it. We're also going to talk about those bowl game rings. That's the topic that seems to be drawing some momentum. We chatted about it a little bit last night after the backlash in some corners that we see on social media, and there is quite a debate out there, so we'll talk about that as well. Got to talk about Aaron Hernandez at some point. Just a shocking story earlier today that the former Florida Gator and a former NFL tight end, New England Patriots, on the day that his former teammates visit the White House, he apparently takes his own life in prison, and this was after he had beaten the rap on a double murder but was still doing life for a murder that happened subsequent to that, although his lawyers were planning his appeal. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And if you followed Kentucky football for more than 8 or 10 years, you saw him play against the Wildcats. He was a really good college player. He was about to become a really, really good professional player. And imagine being a Patriots team, as much as people love tight ends, Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez on the same roster. You know, like the Patriots needed anything else. But you know his story. It all just went horribly wrong. And there's a really interesting story from the USA Today archives out there on the USA Today Twitter account. And, it doesn't excuse anything that this man did. But there is quite the backstory to how his life went in the wrong direction. And as much as I at times dislike Urban Meyer, I give him a lot of credit on one hand for trying to help this young man back when he was a young man. He was 27 when he died today. But on the other hand, the cynic in me says, would Urban Meyer have done this for a third string, offensive tackle? So anyhow, we'll chat about that as well. Phil Simms moving within the CBS football family. I don't know, Curtis, if you saw this one, but they're not going to put him on the next tier of games, which is what I thought he would do. They would do at CBS. They're moving him to the NFL today, which, as much as I enjoy that program, this is nothing against the guys who are on that show, Boomer Esiason and Bill Cowher, Bart Scott, James Brown, who I used to know a little bit. But this just seems like a real slap in the face to a guy. And I'm not just saying this because he's a Kentucky native. He's from Louisville, went to Moorhead. It seems like a terrible step down for him. Not that there's anything wrong with being on a nationally televised pro football show each Sunday. And I know he'll still do some stuff for Showtime, which is owned by CBS. But to take him off the lead game and not put him on the second game, but to put him on a show where you're lucky if you get, 30 to 45 seconds to talk in between all the other guys, that just seems like an odd thing to do. Am I overreacting there?
He should have been better at his job, and he wouldn't have got demoted. I mean, let's be honest. That's what it all comes down to. CBS didn't think he was very good, so they demoted him.
You are totally wrong.
Why did he get demoted then?
Because they grabbed Tony Romo, and they think they can make hay with Tony Romo. They think they can grab more viewers.
So an unproven guy is better than Phil Simms?
No, he's not. I can't imagine he would be. But that's what CBS is hoping.
I don't think Phil Simms is very good.
Well, see, I like him. I like him a lot.
Well, you're biased because he's from Kentucky.
Well, you dislike him because I like him.
No, I don't know. I'm terrible at judging that, but I mean, there's tons of people that do follow it that complain about him. I follow a few sports media people, and they say he's one of the worst commentators in calling pro football. So,
yeah, and a lot of them say he's one of the best. Look, Chris Collinsworth wins the Emmy every year. His critics are the loudest.
I think they're critical not from him, calling the game, but just how he is kind of pompous.
They say stuff like, he doesn't know anything about football. All these guys with big profiles have big targets on their back. There's no question about it. I watch a lot of the CBS games because I like the teams that we have on our network, and I think Sims does a good job. I'd be really curious to see how Tony Romo does, and everything that I've read about him has been written by people who say they believe he understands or has a working knowledge of what it's going to take, but he has no idea how much work goes into this. You don't just show up and do it because you played football.
Also, I do kind of wonder how much Sims was hurt calling those Thursday night games where they were just terrible football, where people were just in a complaining mood.
Yep, I think that's a good point.
Decided to complain about him as well as the bad football on their TV.
They were the worst. Those games were the absolute worst. And CBS crammed them down our throats.
Why don't you talk to somebody over there?
I have.
They actually take your calls? Or?
I didn't say that. I left a lot of messages. So anyhow, that's the move there, and it's just a bizarre way to do business. And while we're talking bowl games, another headline: Oklahoma State has given out rings to its players. Oklahoma State, like Kentucky, lost its bowl game.
Well, now, then they shouldn't get anything, right?
Oklahoma, we'll get to that. However, Oklahoma State had a much better record than Kentucky did, but Oklahoma State officially ended the year 10-3. Now, I had completely forgotten about this, but I read about it. It was interesting. Oklahoma State lost the Alamo Bowl to Central Michigan, which is an odd score when you look at it, because you don't quite think about Central Michigan jumping up and beating Oklahoma State. But in fact, it did. However, Central Michigan scored the winning touchdown on a play that never should have happened. That's been determined. That's not just me saying it. That everybody has said that. Everybody who looked at it, where the officials said it, and, you know, if the bowl people had any say in it, they said it. It happened. The referees screwed up, gave Central Michigan one more play, and Central Michigan won the game. But Oklahoma State still refuses to accept it. And on the bowl game, on the bowl rings, instead of 10-3, which officially was their record in the eyes of college football, they put 11-2. How about that? Mike Gundy, earlier in the season, said both teams should be credited with a win. He said, if you're not willing to go back and say we're going to correct the error, give Oklahoma State the win, let Central Michigan keep the win, and go on down the road. But he said, if I don't try to do what's right for my players, I wouldn't want to play for me. When you look at it for our players, a critical error that was made shouldn't cost them a win for the rest of their life, period. That's the way I see it. What do you think?
Gundy has a fantastic mullet, and the mind inside it is great for his players, but, I mean, what they put on their ring is their own business. They can do whatever they want. But, I mean, the records are the records. Those are, you know, when you look back in the standings, they're going to disagree with your ring. So you're going to have to explain that every time.
By the way, I misspoke. It was a regular season game, not the Alamo Bowl. But that was the ring they got for playing in the Alamo. They actually won the Alamo Bowl. But they were stubborn about their one-loss record, and they put 11-2 instead of 10-3. I'd be okay with that. I'd be okay with both teams being correct. Look, in all fairness, they didn't lose that game. And technically, Central Michigan didn't win that game. So, anyhow, a lot of talk about rings right now. Not sure why that is. I do know why people are talking about the Kentucky rings. And we're going to talk about that here in just a minute. But as we go to the break, I urge you to read this USA Today story. And the one thing that jumped to me off the computer screen, this was a story that was written back when Aaron Hernandez was in college. And I had read this at one point, did not read much about it, but he had lost his father at a young age. His father was only 49 when he died. He died from complications in surgery. A routine hernia operation went bad, and his father suddenly died. And evidently, Hernandez just went off the rails emotionally and just had a very difficult time handling that. And this was before he went off to Florida, but Urban Meyer apparently did do quite a bit to help him. But one of the things that stuck out was, and I had seen this, you know, a few times with Hernandez, some of the photos. This is one of the guys who is covered with tattoos from the waist up. Something I can't relate to it. I don't understand it, but a lot of guys do it. And he was one of them. On one side of his body, evidently, was everything that's good. He was trying to explain the tattoos to the writer. And on his right shoulder, starting from his right shoulder, everything good, including a tattoo representing God's hands, a nod to his big brother, to his father, the day he died, the sun representing all the good days he had with his dad. Beneath those rays, clouds and rain, because he said it all ends in heaven. And then he pointed to his wrist, which apparently had angels on it. Then there's his left arm. Jesus' hands on the cross, and that represented, he said, the pain we all go through. Then some favorite quotes of his father, the phrase self-made, and a spider web. And Hernandez said, spiders create their own path. I make my own decisions. I don't blame anyone. So maybe that's a little insight into just how life got away from him, and he did just horrible things. I'm not trying to present him as a victim at all. You can feel bad for his family, his daughter, and in fact, there's a theory out there that he took his own life to somehow, within the legal system, make it tougher for anybody to get their hands on the money that he has left his daughter. So I don't know. If you're of any interest, it's at USA Today on their Twitter site. The link is there. But it's a horrible story. It really is. When we come back, we'll talk about those Kentucky rings. Curtis has strong feelings about it, if you don't already know. We'll hear about that. 280-228-7800-606-4263. Tweet us at BigBlueInsider1. Derek Willis is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. The Wildcat who has made a name for himself in the All-Star Games. A late rush in his career could carry him places. We're back in a minute. 630 WLAP. Now put your hands up, up in the club, club. Just broke up, I'm doing my own. I don't think this was the kind of ring she was singing about. I could be wrong. Curtis is way hipper than I am. I know you've watched this video over and over, and I don't blame you for that. But from what I can tell, I didn't see any bowl game rings in that video the few times I've seen it. Can you correct me on that, or can you substantiate?
It was in the extended cut.
Ah, okay. That's what you kids watch when you're in the club, am I right?
Sure.
Yeah, let's go with that. Welcome back to the Big Blue Insider. Dick Gabriel, Curtis Birch, 280-228-7800-606-4263. Tweet us at Big Blue Insider 1. People are upset for whatever reason that the Kentucky football players got rings for going to the bowl game. And we talked about it a little bit last night on the abbreviated version of the show. Yesterday, the football program, the whatever you want to call it, the UK football account, tweeted out, as far as I know, one photo with the message, we handed out our bowl rings or something like that. And then it just took off. Players tweeted, retweeted, took pictures of each other's rings, of their own rings, all that stuff. And predictably, the protests began to roll in, both from people who don't like the UK program, but also people who claim to be fans of the UK program. I can understand one a heck of a lot more than I can the other, but what I don't understand is the fact that it seemed to catch people by surprise. Because as we mentioned last night, teams have been rewarding their players with trinkets like this for decades, if not a ring, a watch, or some kind of pendant, or something that signifies that they went to the bowl game, which it was pointed out to me by the director of the Cotton Bowl 30-something years ago, that the bowl game is a reward for everybody, coaches, players, and fans. And does it matter who wins? Not really. I mean, it might in today's playoff structure. And it's great for bragging rights, and it makes your record look better. There's no question about it. But in the big picture thing, when you're talking about recruiting, building a program, extra practices, all that stuff we've come to know and understand about bowl games, that's where it is. Just be in the postseason. Now, we're just happy being there. That's not good enough. You don't want your players saying that. But I guess I don't understand, and I think, Curtis, for once you're with me on something like this, right?
I think I understand why UK fans can be, or not can be, are mad. And it has nothing to do with actually not liking the ring. I think a good portion of the fan base loves to talk some trash to rivals, such as Tennessee and Louisville specifically. And Louisville basketball gave out a ring to those graduate transfers that didn't get to play in the NCAA tournament a few years ago. Kentucky fans made fun of that. And they also made fun of Butch Jones for calling his team the champions of life or whatever thing he said. And they view this as something similar. So, turnabout being fair play, both Louisville and Tennessee fans were making fun of this ring. I think they got very upset about that. But I don't recall any of the Kentucky players making fun of either Tennessee or Louisville for doing those things. So I think people are mad that now, and I think it's ridiculous that this is how it's used in some circles, but rival fans have ammunition to make fun of your team.
And if that's all it is, then yeah, I think it's pretty silly. Some people have ridiculed the fact that whoever decided, I've got to think Mark Stoops signed off on it, but whoever decided to put the, mentioned the win over Louisville on one side of the ring, that has come under great scrutiny and derision. And you pointed something out to me, Curtis. Not that I'm trying to pit UK versus U of L here, but as you said, there are some U of L fans who have ridiculed Kentucky for this. What was on a U of L ring recently?
Yeah, I don't know what year this is from because I don't pay super close attention.
It would have to be 2 years ago.
Yeah, so it was a screenshot of an article sent to me about Louisville getting their rings, and it says the ring has commemorates the 5-game win streak against Kentucky on one side and the bowl win over Texas A&M on the other.
Yeah. I mean, 5-game win streak over Kentucky. Hey, you want to celebrate that? That's a big deal. That's your business. Put it on your ring. That's fine. But if your team loses to that same ball club and they want to celebrate that, it's going to go on their ring, right?
I do find it ironic that, you know, people who, you know, this probably impacts like the most diehard Kentucky fans the most. They like either one way or the other what they think about it. But, you know, if there's one game on the schedule that means the most, it's the Louisville game.
Right.
So you think they would be okay with them commemorating that win. Because in their minds, it was probably the most important game
sure.
that year.
Absolutely.
I mean, and you when you beat how many – the Heisman Trophy is normally given to a guy that wins a lot of football games. So beating a Heisman Trophy-winning quarterback on the road,
yep.
Why wouldn't you commemorate that?
And they, you knew that day. I mean, you knew he was the winner. You knew he was the guy. That's how good a season he had. The one that kind of tickles me and puzzles me as well is the notion that they are rewarding mediocrity. And granted, 7-6 is not a great record. 8-5 would have looked a lot better, although people would have complained about that. But the fact that you would begrudge it, you're a fan and you would begrudge this. And look, if you're a fan, you spend money, you can have whatever opinion you want. You can do whatever you want. I just find that kind of odd. And to Curtis's point, you were probably jumping up and down wherever you were when your team beat Louisville. You know, did you feel mediocre at that point? No. So did losing to Georgia Tech suddenly turn that from a successful season into a mediocre season? I don't think so. I think the fact that we were all speculating as to whether or not, and I'm talking about you and me, media and fans alike, to a point we're wondering, is Mark Stoops going to be able to keep his job? And then they turned things around at a point where they beat a good Louisville team, as Curtis reminds us, on the road. And it was not that U of L had a bad day. That was a great football game. And they get a bowl bid. And they not only go to, not to, and I trust me, I like both games, not to the Music City Bowl, not to the Liberty Bowl, to Jacksonville to play against a tougher opponent. One I think they should have beaten, but they didn't. So, I don't know. This is just all – it's kind of amusing, really, but I find it interesting. We'll come back and talk to Derek Willis in just a minute. 630 WLAP.
By wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire.
Welcome back to the Big Blue Insider. Dick Gabriel, Curtis Birch, awaiting the call of Derek Willis. And while we do that, I will tell you that, and we'll go through this again as well, but he and Dominic Hawkins will be signing autographs at the following places on the following days. Tomorrow, the Froyos of Kentucky in Corbin from 3:30 to 4:30. So if you're in that area, 3:30 to 4:30 at Froyos down in Corbin. On Friday the 21st, they'll be in Richmond. It's the Soft Shoe location from 4:30 to 6.
So don't go to the Hard Shoe.
That's right. Exactly right. And then on Saturday, the 22nd, two full hours, 11 to 1, in front of the University of Pikeville on Hambly Boulevard. And apparently this will be part of Hillbilly Days. So you have three opportunities to grab an autograph from one of your favorite Wildcats. He joins us now on the Celebrity Hotline. Mr. Willis, how are you, sir? Thanks for calling in.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, we're just talking a little basketball, and I'm curious if you enjoy signing autographs, because you're going to be signing a lot of them in the last 3 days. And I know you signed a lot during your career, but do you enjoy that?
Yeah, I've never not enjoyed it. I always embrace the fans, and they come up to me and want to take a picture, and have me sign something, anything, talk to them for a minute. I've always been pretty good about it, tried to. And definitely enjoying the process of it right now.
Tell me the truth. When you were young, did you practice your autograph because you knew you were going to be asked for it someday?
No, I was just a kid. I'd be outside, just playing basketball, anything. So, no, not really.
Would have been a waste of time, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Let's work backwards now. You've been playing in some of these all-star gatherings, for lack of a better term. How did you prepare yourself for those games? Because obviously you've always been a team-first guy, but these games are more about you showing off your skills. What was your attitude going into these games?
Just go out there and play, try and have fun with it, try and be defensive-minded. I know, you said it perfectly. They're all-star games, and you know how those go. It's like one pass shot or somebody's dribbled at the court and taking a Steph Curry three ball. So I just try to go out there and, just play hard. And that's what a lot of the, people wanted to see.
How well did practicing against the great players that you had as teammates for 4 years, and then in the offseason they'd come back, you've been working against those guys for the last 4 years. How did it prepare you? How well did it prepare you?
It definitely made me a better player. Main reason why I went to Kentucky, aside from the fans, I go against Julius Randle freshman year, and this next year I'm going against, Carl and all the bigs we had back. So it's just helped me grow as a player, and then with Coach Cal and the coaching staff, they've helped me understand the game even more than I ever have.
That was my next question. I remember watching you play in high school, and then the progress you made through your career at Kentucky. How far did you grow? How far did you come, Derek, in the last 4 years?
I came a long way, both, on the court, off the court. Started on the court, like I said, I've understood the game really well. Defensively, I feel like, I started to be more aware towards the end of this season. And, off the court, Coach Cal has definitely helped me mature as a man. I felt like I've always tried to, do good in that department. And, I can't thank my coaches enough for all that.
Hey, Derek, this is Curtis. Speaking of your coach there, did you get a chance to see his documentary, The 30 for 30, on him?
I have not, actually. I'm actually really looking forward to it. People keep telling me that I'm in a couple parts of it. So, I'd like to check it out. And I was in Virginia at the time when it aired, so I missed it.
Okay, well, then I'll ask you about, we were talking about your All-Star games earlier. You were named the MVP of the Reese's College All-Star game. What did you get for that? Did you get, a lifetime supply of Reese's Pieces? Or?
No, I wish. They gave me – I had a choice between – it was like a bag of Reese miniature cups, the little ones, or it was you can get two of the big Reese cups, a cupcake size, and I was just give me a little bag. And that was pretty much it. They gave me a little plaque, and, that was the gist of it, though.
And which one did you say you chose?
I chose the little Reese's. I just brought home a big bag of little Reese's.
Make them last longer, right?
Yeah, I try to.
I think that's a wise choice. I think I would have gone that way. I mentioned you playing in high school, and I remember watching you play over at that event, the Joe Hall event in Montgomery County High School. Do you remember that?
Montgomery, yeah. I think Joby Hall was there. Yeah. I think we played Rowan County.
I remember going over there and watching you, and I had never seen you play. I'd read about you, but I remember thinking, okay, he's good enough. He's going to play. But I have to be honest with you, I never really wondered if you'd get the opportunity to develop into the kind of player you became, because I really wondered about whether the minutes would be available. How did you make that happen? And was that ever a concern for you? I'm good, but I'm not going to get the chance to show how good I am.
Of course. I mean, it definitely affected my confidence, you know, freshman, sophomore year. If you've ever seen The Longest Yard, the character Richie, who he's like, I guess, like a Latin descendant, you know, Mexican descent or something. There's a part where Adam Sandler's going to the basketball court to recruit. pretty much like the black guys come play football. And I kind of like felt like Richie at the time, where I was like, man, there's no way I'm going to play. So I guess, it definitely hit my confidence, though. And just when I had my opportunity out there, I took it. And that's when I kind of had my little breakout season junior year.
I was going to say, that was a big time for you, wasn't it, where they needed you and you came through. How much did your confidence soar during that season?
It was really good for me. There was still some times where, like, I'd be hesitant, especially with, like, shooting. I felt like I was didn't want to, like, shoot too much. And it was a lot of, like, thinking when I didn't need to think. I just needed to go out there and play. And once I understood that, then it became very easy for me.
I would, if there's anything I could do, I think, as a college basketball player, especially at Kentucky, believe it or not, maybe it's a dunk, but if I could throw in a three-pointer in a clutch situation, hear all the inhaling and then the screaming when it splashes the nets, I think that would be the biggest rush there is. What is that like?
It's amazing. It's euphoric, honestly. Just the feeling of, you know, seeing a three, you know, having a dunk in Rupp Arena, anything like that. It's just the best feeling. And I don't know, just, you know, try to go out there, do what I can, and, you know, that's just what I try to do.
Your dunks, though, were all business. It was almost like, you know, you threw it down so quickly, like, I can dunk too, don't forget about that, but you didn't make a huge deal about it. Was that by design?
No, that's just how I am. I mean, it's just how, like, you're out there, you make a play, and you get back, and you just stay in the game.
Yeah.
You know, that's just, you know, you don't want to get too cocky, because then maybe it's the next play you get dunked on, you're like, oh. It kind of kills whatever you had going.
You saw that you won Dunk of the Year on the poll tweeted by the UK basketball account, right?
Oh, really? That's awesome, actually.
Yeah, were you dunked over the guy?
Oh, yeah. No, that was probably the nastiest dunk I think I've ever had. So, yeah, no, it felt so good. But, you know, then again, it is just a play. And, you know, I've seen it was probably not even a couple weeks after that happened that I think that kid or another player on their team like rose up on two dudes and dunked on them like hard. So I mean, it's just how it goes.
What kind of feedback are you getting from scouts and stuff? You were at Portsmouth, one of the biggest scouting events before the NBA stuff. What are they kind of telling you they like about your game?
So I mean, obviously the NBA games kind of transitioned to playing an open court. The big guys are starting to play out on the 3-point line, and they want to look for guys that can shoot. So what the teams that I had met with, they really liked that I could like the pick and pop action, that I could shoot threes. You know, I had I felt like I was an underrated passer, and they noticed that. Also with my athletic ability, they thought, you know, I was more athletic than what I was. And just like a key thing that a guy I met with from Sacramento, he told me, he said, you know, you can shoot threes. He's like, but for that pick and pop action to be more lethal, he was like, you can stretch it out even, you know, a foot or two more. And he's like, that guard tag, when he has to rotate on the weak side, is going to be that much more hard, and it's going to leave you, you know, that much more open. So, you know, that was a pretty interesting tip I took away from that.
And how do you feel about that? What's your – I got to think that you're confident you can make that happen.
Yeah, it is. I think a big part of it is coming with just getting my body stronger. I think that's really the main issue with me right now. I mean, obviously there's always stuff you can work on, but I think just getting my body in, you know, the right shape, getting stronger, being able to – you know, push bigger guys around, and, you know, it's just, like I said, it's just going to elevate my game for real.
Well, that said, what do you do now to get your body in that kind of condition? I mean, I've got to think you've got a head start. I'm not sure how much you've been working out since the season was over, but they get you in pretty good shape at Kentucky, do they not?
Yeah, they do a good job. A lot of it's basketball shape, so where I would look at other schools and like the players they had, they looked like they were, you know, really strong and all this and stuff. But I think I took away from that was where Kenny Payne and even Coach Gallatin's, where we get ran to death. It was a thing where like that strength that other teams had against us, it didn't even matter because we just usually beat them down the court, and you know, we was a transition team as it is, so you know, the strength thing didn't factor in at times. But no, I mean, Kentucky does a great job of, you know, getting you prepared for whatever moves you're going to make.
I think I saw where Coach Calipari went and saw you both in at the Final Four at the Reese's All-Star Game. It was up in Portsmouth. What did it mean to you to have him at both those events?
This is great. I mean, shows the support, you know, Coach Cal has for, you know, seniors. I mean, him flying out to Phoenix to see me, that was great. I think he brought Brad with him, too, so that was cool. And then, you know, he takes, I think it was a big recruiting weekend, you know, the weekend I was in Virginia at Portsmouth. And, you know, he took, you know, took time out of his day and with his busy schedule, you know, to come see me and say what's up and watch my game. So that just goes to show, you know, how loyal of a coach he is, and you know how much his players mean to him. So I can't thank him enough. He's been, you know, great to me.
As we all know, he is quite fond of reminding us that he is a players first coach. What do you guys think? What is your reaction among the players when you hear him say things like that? Does that resonate with you guys? Does it even get back to you guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's cool, and that's why he can do the things he does with, you know, having freshmen come in every year and, you know, the one and done thing. That's why it works here, Kentucky, is because, you know, we know that, you know, he has our back, he has our best interest, and he's going to keep it real with us. A lot of coaches, I feel like at times probably won't keep it real with you, and he's the guy, you know, he'll put it out in front of you, and then if you think it's something wrong with that, then he'll have, you know, Kenny Payne, all the other assistants are behind him, you know, tell him, hey, this is how it is, and if you ain't going to come here and work and, you know, do the things we're asking of you, then you're not going to make it. It's as simple as that.
And yet you and Dom are four-year players, obviously Kentucky kids, but, you know, people wonder now, unfortunately, about four-year players, but your fourth year, both of you, was your greatest year. So that says a lot about guys who do stay in school. You can still develop and get a chance at pro ball, right?
Of course. I mean, everybody's time schedule is different. I mean, some people it's a year. Some people it's 2 years. Some people it's three. I mean, Willie he was a 3 year player. Like he's a top 5-6 pick wherever he was.
Right.
And you know, with me and Dominique, we stayed here 4 years. Got better each year, and you know, learned the game, the ins and outs of it. And you know, now we have the opportunity to play professional basketball. So I mean, it's just how it works, you know.
One of my favorite stories I tell about you, just, you know, in the few times I've had a chance to interview you, you probably don't even remember this, but I think it was before your second year, and you guys, you just had a ton of talent as usual. And I got the impression that on media day when we all surround you guys and ask you the same dumb questions over and over, and you guys handle it really well, by the way, I felt like people were trying to ask you in not so many words, hey, man, you're not going to play. Why are you here? Why didn't you just transfer and go somewhere and be a superstar? And I remember you kind of looked up and you had this look on your face like, God almighty. And you rubbed your eyes and you looked up and you said, I'm just trying to win a championship. And that kind of shut it down. It's like, oh yeah, right. I mean, did that frustrate you at some point where people lost sight of what you came here to do?
Yeah, it's pretty annoying. A lot of it stemmed from a guy making a false, you know, accusation, claim, whatever, about me transferring, and I kind of like, you know, people eat that stuff up and they think more of it than what it is. And,
yeah.
You know, I had to deal with the, you know, repercussions of it, but you know, then again, like I said, ever since I came in freshman year, I wanted to win a championship, and that's all it's about. You know, that's what the fans want, that's what I want, and you know, when you win, good things happen. So that's how I look at it.
We talked about your tour with Dominique across the state and meeting the fans. Has there been any crazy incidents? You had to sign something kind of strange yet? Or has it just been straightforward stuff?
I think, all right. So in Ashland, I think it was a Big Blue Smokehouse. Or no, excuse me, Hazard. It was in Big Blue Smokehouse. And I had about a 90-some-year-old lady come up to me. And she was a sweet lady and all that stuff. And she had gotten posters, whatever, I signed her posters. And then she was like, well, can you sign here? And then she pointed to her chest. And I was like, oh, lady, I don't know. And she was like, it would mean a lot to me. And I was like, I kind of just bit the bullet. And, you know, I signed her shirt. And And then she tried to give me a kiss, and I was like, oh, man, I can't have that. So she tried to kiss me, like, right near the lips, and I ended up, like, leaning my head over, and she kissed me on the neck. But, she's a sweet lady, but I couldn't have that lip action. It was not for me.
I give you major props for even admitting to that story. That's fantastic.
Pretty wild, so, yeah.
Hey, you never know, man. You got 3 more cities coming up this week. You never know what may happen. Well, I'll let you go with this. You've talked about this on senior night leading up to it again, but just one more time, just a Kentucky kid. I love the fact that you talked about that a lot, and I hope part of that was you were sending messages both to John Calipari and to kids around the state. I much admit to you and Dominic Hawkins, I've debated this with people, but it does mean a little extra something, or a lot extra, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if you're listening to this, anybody, you can check out the letter I wrote to the BBN. Kyle Tucker, he sat down with me, and we put it together, and he did an awesome job with it. So, you know, huge props to him. And, it's just, I mean, just like I said, you know, playing a rep arena, it's a euphoric feeling. It's like, you know, you and you're a little kid, and you have, like, your first little crush on a girl or something like that. It's same exact thing. So, you know, I just can't explain enough. It's just one of the feelings you can't really describe.
Yeah. Yeah, and Kyle did a terrific job with yours and with Dominic Hawkins as well. So props to, as you said, to Kyle for that. Hey, by the way, have you set a date yet?
Yeah, August 4th of next year.
All right. Well, listen, best of luck with that. Best of luck with the basketball down the road. Have a great time signing whatever you sign. And we'll, on the other side of the break, we'll give out the times and places again. But, Derek, thanks so much for your time, and we appreciate covering you. You're always a class act, and best of luck. We'll be rooting for you.
Of course. I appreciate that.
All right, man. Thank you. Take care.
All right.
That's Derek Willis. I say former Wildcat, former basketball player, but once a Wildcat, always a Wildcat. And, again, in Corbin, 3:30 to 4:30, Froyo on Thursday. Soft shoe, as Curtis says, not hard shoe, but soft shoe. On Friday in Richmond, 4:30 to 6. And on Saturday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. in Pikeville, in front of the University of Pikeville on Hambly Boulevard, presented by Edward Jones. Part of Hillbilly Days for 2017. Derek Willis and Dominic Hawkins. We're back in just a minute. 6:30, WLAP. Not exactly the same storyline, but we'll take it in a pinch. Maybe she tried to pinch him. That is one of the greatest stories. Good question from Curtis that we've ever had on this show. And if you missed it, if you're just joining us, Derek Willis, Curtis asked him what was the oddest thing perhaps that happened. I'm paraphrasing. And you were just thinking maybe somebody wanted him to what? Sign a baby's backside or something.
Yeah,
right?
Something like that.
Yeah. But instead, what did he say? He called it a 90-something-year-old woman.
Yeah.
Wanted him to sign her chest. And he politely declined. Good for him. And he went the way of decorum.
And then she tried to get a kiss.
That's right.
And he thought it was a little bit too close to the lips. And
yep.
he turned.
He's engaged. He can't be making out with any other women, you know. Not with that wedding all set up. Coming up in hour number two, we'll talk more Kentucky football and basketball. We're also going to talk a little bit about the new baseball stadium over at EKU. There is a terrific link to history involved with the new naming of that stadium. It's a fantastic story. The Reds have set their rotation for the weekend. Brace yourselves, a little baseball talk here in the last minute. Oh, by the way, we're also going to talk about Kentucky's win over Louisville in baseball. But your Reds, Curtis, the Cubs are coming in. They got to do their duty and take at least 2 out of 3. But they're going to start the mighty Tim Adelman on Friday night, Cody Reed on Saturday, and Bronson Arroyo on Sunday. Gramps is going to go again with an ERA of about 8.5.
He got a win.
But he's 1-2, yeah. And you know what? He has pitched the second most innings on the staff. So he's soaking up some innings for him so they can get some people healthy.
First Red pitcher to win a game over the age of 40 since some guy named like Bum Bum or Tum Tum or something in the
1945. How about that? And your boy Joey Votto is about to break the record for most starts at first base since Ted Klazuski. Tell me you know who that is. Attaboy.
Big Blue Insider is on News Radio 630 WLAP and WLAP.com. Get on the show. Call 280-CATS. That's 280-2287. Or toll free at 1-800-606-GAME. That's 1-800-606-4263. Big Blue Insider is brought to you by UK Healthcare. Now, here's Dick Gabriel.
Welcome back to the Big Blue Insider, hour number two of our program, and our thanks again to Derek Willis for joining us on our celebrity hotline and sharing stories. Did a great job, usually does, with interviews, and he'll get a chance. We were just talking in the break, and to his point about the pick and pop now is the way to go in the NBA for whatever reason. That's what the league has become, and more teams are shooting three-pointers, and I like the fact that one of the scouts told him to increase his range from three-point land, make himself more marketable. And you might think that that's pretty obvious, but you know, you're probably not thinking about that when you're at the All-Star games and things like that. But you know, Derek Willis is a strong guy who's got a good eye, as we've all seen. So you know, as Derek pointed out, the thing to do is show you can guard, and he's never been shy about that. He just hasn't been great about it. And if anything holds him back in terms of his development, it'll be that. But I firmly believe, Curtis, that he'll play for somebody next year, whether it's in the D-League or in Europe. But I think a guy like that, with size like that and a frame like that, who can shoot like that, he's going to have a future somewhere. You know, he might not make a $53 million contract, but he'll make a living playing basketball.
Yeah, and even if it's not in the NBA, he can just look at former Kentucky player Darius Miller, who's playing yep. successfully over in Germany, as kind of a roadmap if you want to take that route. And, you know, I'm sure a very capable Darius Miller would take that call and let him know what, you know, the European leagues are like and how to navigate those situations. It's one of those things where, you know, when you have so many players going pro, and, I mean, heck, we've talked to even like Eric Daniels, and those guys have done the same things where all these Kentucky guys have been in many different, you know, leagues around the country. Shimu Evans as well.
Yep.
So there's guys he can reach out to and, you know, find those paths easier than if he was going at it alone.
Not just around the country, but around the world as well. And it's interesting how much money is being paid, at least at the highest level. I got to think there are several levels of league. In China. Randolph Morris playing over there. Jimmer Fredette is averaging 37. He's getting 37 a game over there. The point is, you know, there's money out there to be made, but also the styles of play are different. And I remember when Rob Locke was playing in Spain, I think, or Italy, one of the two. And if you remember Rob here, and that was a while back, you know, he was a banging low post guy. He was okay. People liked him more after he was gone. And I don't mean that in a cynical way. I mean, even though they criticized him when he was here, he played hard. California laid back, but he played hard. And when he left, his presence was missed. People didn't realize, in other words, how much they missed him until he was gone. But because they needed a physicality in the low post. Well, in Europe, he told me he ran up and down the floor and shot the ball. He loved it. He loved the basketball part of it. You know, you practice for an hour a day. You play, he said, twice a week, and he lived in a villa. But he didn't like being overseas and away from his family. And he couldn't wait. He knew how much money he needed to make to start his company. And as soon as he had it, he quit. And I think it was about 10 years. So he had a great run. But it just goes to show you that the brand of basketball, the style of play is so different over there that there's something for everybody, I guess. Speaking of which, I don't know how much you all follow the NBA playoffs. I know we don't get a lot of calls about it, but there are fans out there. And people say, oh, they only play hard during the playoffs, which really isn't true. But they do play harder in the playoffs for obvious reasons. One of the pundits out there, I got to give some, I don't know who it was, give him credit for predicting that the Bulls-Celtics matchup seemed like it was ripe for an upset. Wouldn't be a super upset, but the Celtics clearly favored. Chicago's up 2-0, or would take a 2-0 lead. Yeah, they did. They've got. I'm reading this story and it's poorly written. But anyhow, Rajon Rondo evidently told his teammates that the Celtics during the second game had quit. And he still knows, I think, a couple of those guys. But, you know, the main guys who were there with him when he won a championship are gone. And, of course, he was booed by Boston fans. And to his credit, Rajan said they had to boo me. I was wearing a different jersey. Of course they're going to boo me. But I bring it up because Brad Stevens, the Celtics coach, seems to be the guy, when you talk to Kentucky fans, not that they ever want Calipari to leave, but they know someday he will. So they like to play that game. If he ever did decide to leave for whatever reason, retirement, stupid money from the NBA, joins Donald Trump's cabinet, anything like that, who would you bring in? And a lot of people, when we hear them talk about it, say they believe Stevens would be the best fit. He did a great job at Butler. He has proven in the NBA he knows how to coach. Even though it's a different style, different brand, all that stuff, it's a different world in the NBA. But he has successfully made the transition. And I say that knowing he hasn't been in the NBA all that long, but it tells you how smart he is, that he can adjust and adapt. I don't know, though, that he would be the guy for this job. Do you?
I think he's the smartest basketball coach I've ever been around. When they were they had the NCAA tournament at Rupp, you mentioned that last night, that was his last year at Butler. And that press conference, I feel like I've never had a coach talk basketball X's and O's more, you know, easily and have everyone in the room understand it the way he did it. His problem, I think, is basically that he doesn't have a talented roster, and that's why they win in the regular season because, as you mentioned, guys play harder in the playoffs. Yeah. They don't rest. You know, the superstars are in every game during the playoffs.
That's right.
And he just doesn't have the talent. I think he would fit, and it would be in a current scenario right now, he could fit because – he would be able to roll over Calipari's NBA success and keep that recruiting going because he was in the NBA.
You're right.
So he would sell everyone, come to Kentucky. I know how to get you to the NBA. Yep. I was just there.
Yep. No, there's no question about that. And, you know, I've got a few years on you, but I'm sure you remember when Pitino was here. That's what he did. He had just come from the Knicks, only 2 years. And everybody talks about his failure with the Celtics. He was a success with the Knicks. He stabilized the Knicks, and he was there 2 years as a head coach. He was there for a year or two as an assistant as well prior to Providence. He stabilized the Knicks his first year. They won, I think, 50-something games his second year, and they won the Atlantic Division. And they went from the Garden being one-half to two-thirds full to being sold out again, Madison Square Garden. One of his key players on that team was Kenny Walker. He helped Kenny Walker resurrect his pro career. Kenny was a hit immediately in New York. He did very well. The knock on Kenny when he was drafted was he couldn't shoot. So Kenny went into the gym. The moment he was drafted, he probably got up and went to the gym. No. But he did spend an enormous amount of time, he told me, in the gym and got up hundreds of jump shots every day. And became a good shooter and was doing well in the league. And then he hurt his back. And that really, really set him back with the Knicks, who were mediocre, by the way. That's why they needed to change coaches. And it looked like he was on his way out. Other reporters told me, I don't know if Kenny would tell you that, but other reporters said they weren't sure he was going to survive. Well, here comes Rick Pitino. And he did much more of the full court pressure stuff. Like he did here, he did much more of that in New York than he did in Boston. And players will tell you it can be a career killer. It can really grind you down and shorten your career. But that's the only way. Like Kentucky, that's the only shot the Knicks had. Yes, they had Patrick Ewing, but they didn't have much around him. They did have Bill Cartwright, who was playing on a bad foot. I watched him hobble through the Knicks locker room, and it pained me to watch him walk. But Pitino, putting Kenny Walker in that full-court defense, suddenly the crowd fell in love again with Kenny. You know why? He'd make steals, and he'd fill lanes on the break, and he'd throw down dunks. And remember now, this is a guy who won the NBA dunk contest, so Kenny knew how to throw him down. So when Pitino comes here, it's like, I'm in the NBA, like Curtis said to Stevens could do. I can get you there. I know what it takes. I've been there. My question to you, young squire, is could Brad Stevens do the marketing job that it takes? And mind you, I did not say that Calipari is doing, because I'm convinced there isn't anybody out there, at least that we know of. There might be somebody, but we've never heard of him. But in terms of the high-profile guys who would be in the picture for a job like this, whenever, I'm not trying to run him off, we're just spitballing here in the offseason because the NBA playoffs are upon us. Who could do this job the way, do you even approach the way Calipari's doing it? Because this guy never rests. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is there somebody out there?
No, I don't think so. Not in the current landscape that I can pick out. But
well, for one thing, it's hard to pick up on that because what other program needs this? You know, you've got to have the ambassadors at places like North Carolina, Duke, Kentucky. I've got to think Archie Miller needs to be like this, don't you?
Yeah, especially considering where Indiana is
exactly
at this very moment. I think Stevens would go about it in a different way. He wouldn't be as big into catchphrases and those kind of things. But I think Kentucky fans would still enjoy hearing from him whenever he decided to speak.
Oh, sure.
And the reason this is all coming up, and I know I touched on it last night on Twitter, because there was an article where our Celtics fans turning on Brad Stevens. He's 2-10 now in the playoffs, which is not a very good record.
Nope.
But as we talked about earlier, why that is, I think. Boston is really an interesting franchise, they have this high pick coming up this year, and you know they have a lot of pieces that fit together well, but they're not designed to win much of anything in the playoffs at this point. So I don't know how he would do it, but he's such a smart guy. I think he would be able to work it out somehow if he took the job at Kentucky.
Riley Cat just tweeted at us and said the Celtics don't have a playoff gear. I think he's probably right. I think it goes exactly to what you were just saying, Curtis, in that, you know, they're not. And by the way, with Isaiah Thomas out because of the death of his sister.
He's been playing, but
He went home for the funeral. So, but it just has affected the team.
Yeah, you can definitely see that.
Yeah, definitely. So anyhow, that's our award-winning NBA coverage for the evening. But every now and then you sort of drift off into that. Well, what if Calipari were to leave? Whatever happened? I mean, like we said, someday he will, you know, and maybe by then we'll know who the next great ambassador is, that kind of thing. But, you know, did we know that about Calipari when he was at Memphis? Well, kind of, because he went in there and sort of breathed life back into that program, a program that had been good back in the 70s and the 80s and had fallen on hard times and needed a salesman in a pro market. The NBA is popular down there in the state of Memphis. And I call it that because the rest of the state of Tennessee doesn't really like to claim Memphis, but there's a lot going for that town. I like it. I hope you do too. We'll come back and talk more Kentucky football, baseball, basketball in just a few here on 630 WLAP.
2-2 in the air to short left. Rex will make the grab. McKay tags. Here he comes to the plate. The throw comes through, and he's going to be tagged out. They'll go to third. The tag there. Out. How about that? A triple play. And that ends the second.
I've seen triple plays before, you know, like on the little league level, stuff like that. Generally, it's if kids, you know, lose sight of the ball, and oh, they just tagged out Johnny. Hey, that's a triple play. I've never seen one like that, of course, covering Kentucky baseball because, well, they don't think they've ever had one. In fact, they know they've never had one in the last 14 years. It sounds odd to say, but that's how far back the official records go. And the reason is the way to put record books together, of course, is to grab the official score books at the end of the year and go through all them and all that stuff. Well, that's a lot of work, and it's work that they weren't spending on college baseball back then. It's a big deal now, but it wasn't back then, and they don't have all the score books that go back. Nobody knows where they are. And so when you think about it, well, what's the next step? Grab the box scores. Well, where are they? Nobody knows that either. And they're not all in the newspaper archives as well, because of course they didn't carry them all. So anyhow, it's unfortunate that they don't have those records officially going back beyond 03, but I can tell you this. People have been tweeting at me, and I think you have to go back to the 20s to see a 7-2-6 triple play in the major leagues.
And you saw that one live, right?
Yeah, it was super. It was, in fact, we thought it was 7-2-5 because the tag was made at third base, and it all happened so quickly that and Tyler Marshall was playing third base. He and Connor Heady, you know, they don't look alike, but their builds are similar. So it all happened so quickly. You look down there, and you think it's Tyler Marshall. Well, no, it's Connor Heady. And look, only baseball nerds care about this stuff. I get that. But I just think it's interesting that it is rare. And it was all part of this big, bizarre evening of baseball last night at Cliff Hagen Stadium. And it was a sellout. They're saying it was a record crowd, record regular season. I keep putting that addendum on there because I'm pretty sure they drew more than 4,000 people to the NCAA tournament back in 06. But that has to be an asterisk kind of thing because they had temporary seats for those games. But I can tell you this. Obviously, the stands were jammed. The deck at the Cliff, which they call the Cliff, was jammed. There were so many people out there in the right field pavilion, if you will, that a lot of people, I mean solid humanity, back in the parking lot, sitting on vehicles, partying, and watching the game. Standing room only, you know, the grassy areas. The grassy knolls that are there. It was fantastic. And I was sitting in the booth next to Neil because the press box was full. Brian Milan, who produces the Nick Mangione show, the sports director, KYT, walked in and whispered to me, he said, the traffic is backed up as far as you can see it. And I jumped out there and looked over the side. It's just cars everywhere for that game. I have seen big crowds before, of course, and I'm not just talking about the tournament at that ballpark. And it's usually for U of L. And unfortunately, for the sake of Kentucky fans, they've gone away disappointed. It seems like the biggest crowds I've seen, Kentucky's lost the game, and the games weren't all that great. This was really an entertaining game. If you're a Kentucky fan, you see your team get up 11-0. I mean, just pounding Louisville. And then all of a sudden, the momentum changes. And that's what can happen in college baseball. And suddenly, it's 11-7, and all the momentum belongs to Louisville, and then the Kentucky bullpen comes through. But I can tell you this, there was a moment in that game where I thought it was a deja vu situation where Kentucky was leading big and tried another safety squeeze to push in another run. It did not work, but I'm sure some bad looks were shot across the diamond and people were wondering. I heard somebody out in the stand, what in the world are they bunting for? They're up 9 runs or whatever it was. Well, and in fact, a friend of mine texted me and said, why in the world are they doing that? And I said, it's college baseball with metal bats and bullpens that don't hold up like major league bullpens. We have a tendency to watch these games and manage right along and think, all right, I'll bring in this guy or bring in that guy or take that guy out, you know, that kind of stuff. It's not the same. We're conditioned, if you watch baseball much, you're conditioned to manage right along based on what you see in the big leagues every night. It's different in college ball. They stay with pitchers longer. You know, they try to score. They pour it on, try to score as many runs as they can, especially against a team like Louisville, because they're perfectly capable of coming back from a deficit that big. And almost did. The same thing happened to Texas A&M. Kentucky pulled off an extra safety squeeze, and there was a dust-up. There was nearly a fist fight over it down there in College Station. And wouldn't you know, A&M almost came all the way back. That's just the way college baseball works. So it was a great night, great game. They finally pulled it out. And just now, Derek Terry has posted this on KentuckyRivals.com, Cats Illustrated, with Zach Rex and Marcus Carson set to graduate. Kentucky coaches need quality outfielders who could play right away. And they, Roe Fanning, got a commitment from Ryan Johnson, 6'3", 215, from San Jacinto College, or Jacinto. He is committed to the Wildcats. Played on TCU's College World Series team as a freshman before he transferred to JUCO ball. So he knows what's what. Back in just a minute, 630 WLAP. This another ring reference?
Yep. I think it works on many levels.
I think it really does, and I'm proud of you, as always. Welcome back to the Big Blue Insider. We talked about Kentucky's win last night over Louisville. Of course, the Wildcats, not the only program in these here parts. And I can tell you this, as a guy who spent a lot of time on the EKU campus, I am really happy for the folks over in Richmond. They got the renovation of their baseball stadium completed, and they did a terrific thing. They named it after Earl Combs. If you're a real baseball fan, you know that name, and if not, you need to. Earl Combs played for the 27 Yankees, who are considered by many the greatest team in the history of the sport. Of course, big names featuring Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, but the leadoff batter, who was a great player in his own right, was Earl Brian Combs, born in Pebworth, Kentucky in 1899. Died in Richmond in 1976, attended EKU, is a Hall of Famer, and the stadium has been named after Earl Combs. It's a great move, and I know the family was extremely happy about it. And Earl's grandson, Don, joins us on the Kennedys, rather on the Celebrity Hotline. Don, thanks for joining us. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Dick. Thanks for having me, and it indeed is a great honor and befitting for my grandfather and the family, as well as myself, are just ecstatic about what they've done at Eastern and in doing this.
What was your reaction when you got the news?
Well, certainly, you know, really excited for that. Previously, there had been a residence hall named for my grandfather, and with, you know, changes in college campuses these days, that dormitory had been removed and had been torn down. But at that time it occurred, you know, the leadership at Eastern had conveyed, gosh, we'd like to do something. We're not going to forget about your grandfather. He did great things for Eastern and is worthy of you know, a memorial somewhere. And it was befitting that they selected the new renovated stadium to put his name attached to that.
I don't really know how old you are, how far back you go. I'm wondering, Did you have a relationship with him, or was he gone by the time you arrived?
Oh, no, I'm 54 years old.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You know, he died in 1976. Right. I was you know, obviously 13, 14 years old, and most definitely had a relationship with him, you know, to the extent that, to me, he was my grandfather,
right.
You know, a man who had great acclaim and great achievements. But by the same token, as a child, you know, he was he's my grandpa.
Yeah. Now, that said, though, did you know, quote-unquote, who he was?
Oh, most definitely. I actually attended the Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 1970, sat on the front row.
Great.
At the end of July, and with my entire family, my sisters and certainly my mother and dad, and my dad, who worked at Eastern for many years as the athletic director.
That's right.
You know, he had two brothers that were older than he, and their families went as well, so it was as well as many other family members, brothers and sisters of his and cousins and whatnot. But, yes, I knew that he had a great acclaim, and I knew that he was a great ball player. You know, did I conceive that as a child? Probably not. As a 54-year-old man that I do now and can look at that and reflect upon that, of what he accomplished and absolutely how outstanding that is.
Yeah. By the way, your dad, I interviewed your dad several times while he was the AD there. He was a swimmer, wasn't he, your dad?
He was a swimming coach.
Okay.
I mean, he swam some, but yes, he coached swimming
That's
at
right.
Eastern for a number of years and then became the athletic director in the early 70s through about 1991 or 92.
Gotcha. We're talking with Don Combs, Jr., correct?
Correct.
Okay. Who was the grandson of the great Earl Combs, for which the stadium renovation over at EKU has been named. Earl Combs, part of Murderers Row. Six players in that lineup have made the Baseball Hall of Fame. Gehrig, Ruth, Tony Azeri, Herb Pennock, Wade Hoyt, and Earl Combs. And he's from Owsley County. And according to Wikipedia, as a child, he played baseball games with tree limbs as bats and baseballs made out of string and material from old shoes. Had you heard that tale?
I had. And, you know, he was the youngest boy of a family of about, I believe there was nine of them. So as the youngest boy, you can imagine a mountain family who were farmers and very rural had to entertain themselves. And so as a child, he clearly was trying to keep up with his older brothers and sisters, for that matter, in after their chores were done and being able to play at the end of the day. And so that probably was to his benefit in terms of driving his quickness and his coordination and speed was the fact that he was trying to keep up with them. I heard my dad talk about his uncles, obviously my grandfather's brothers, and my grandfather would say, you know, there were better athletes. Some of my brothers were better athletes than me. So that must speak to,
wow,
you know, the athletic ability God given, of course, and certainly developed in a different way in that era than what we do and see with athletes today.
I love the story about how he came to play at EKU. He went to college, which at that time it was going to be a two-year program, to become a school teacher, didn't he? And he just sort of fell into baseball. I know he played baseball as a child, but somebody noticed him and encouraged him to go out for baseball at EKU, right?
Yeah, that's right. He went to a one-room schoolhouse, and, you know, if you think of you know, one of the most economically challenged counties in Kentucky, yeah, even to this day, Owsley County, to become a school teacher. So he clearly, you know, valued education and wanted to go back and become a teacher. But certainly while here, I think some of that athletic ability that he had began to show up. I think he was a member of the track team, so he was very fleet of foot.
Yep.
He was encouraged to play in a game of baseball and certainly had done that with his you know, friends and older brothers growing up. And I think as I read the account, he dazzled the it was a game between the students and the faculty.
Yeah.
And he more or less dominated the game. And so at that point in time, the school was putting together a baseball team, and so he began to participate in that. And then through, you know, at that time, semi-pro baseball,
right,
was probably a big thing. You know, the Lexington Rios and then American Legion Ball was popular, mm-hmm, was a popular outlet for, you know, young men and boys, and he excelled in Central Kentucky in doing that. So caught the eye of the Louisville Colonels, and in 1924, you know, made his way to play for them.
And I did not know this, Don, until I read up on your grandfather, but Joe McCarthy, who later on became the manager of some of those great Yankee teams, was the manager in Louisville, which I just,
right,
love
that's
stuff
exactly
like
right.
That.
That's exactly right. That probably was a connection for,
yeah,
him,
yeah,
at the time that he was in Louisville. You know, Joe McCarthy had been here, ultimately made his way to the Yankees, and so was quite familiar with my grandfather's abilities. You know, that was a positive probably for both of them along the way.
And it's interesting, too, that there was a bidding war for his contract. And by the way, he decided on a career in baseball because he was only going to make $37 a month teaching school at Owsley County, it says here. But there was a bidding
That's
war
right.
for his contract, and the Yankees paid $50,000, which is equivalent today of $600,000, for his contract.
Yeah.
So clearly they saw something in him.
That's right. That's right. And another kind of funny anecdotal tale of that was, I heard my dad tell the story as well, is that his parents were very devout Christians,
mm-hmm,
and they really didn't like for my grandfather to play on Sundays until they found out that he could earn $10 a day by playing on Sunday, and then certainly it became okay to do that.
Absolutely. It's a different time, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We're talking to Don Combs, who is the grandson of the great Earl Combs, now the namesake of EKU's renovated baseball stadium. Don Combs, or rather Earl Combs, played at EKU, was born in Pebworth, Kentucky, in Owsley County, and left EKU, went on to play for the great New York Yankees, the Murderers Row team. He played for 11 or 12 years, but was part of that 27 team, was the leadoff man. And by the way, you mentioned speed. I'm sure you know he led the American League in triples three times. And
that's right.
Just has terrific stats, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And certainly 27 of all is the standout year for him. You know, he led the league in base hits with 231 that year. And that actually was a record, a Yankee team record, until Don Mattingly broke that record in the mid-'80s.
Yeah.
So for a better part of 60 years, that was a team record. And again, remembering they played, 152 ball games now, 154 ball games, and they play 162 now. So fewer games and fewer opportunities. But nonetheless, you know, he did lead the league in hits that year. Now, I will go on to say that his batting average that year was .356.
Not bad.
Which was identical to Babe Ruth with .356. Lou Gehrig that particular year hit .373.
Wow.
And another member of that Murderers Row, Bob Musial, hit .339. So you take, there's your 1, 2, 3, and 4 hitters right there. So clearly, you know, Murderers Row indeed.
People like to compare other teams, including the 75 Reds, to that ball club. It's tough to compare eras, but that's why it's fun, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it also prompts us to go back through the record books and start reading about these guys. And by the way, I interviewed Wade Hoyt once, and I said something to him about, you know, the way the game has changed and all the travel that guys have to do. He's like, don't give me travel. He said, we had to ride those trains, which were really uncomfortable, and wear those wool uniforms and all that stuff. So in a lot of ways, it was tougher back then.
That's right. And you know, you speak of the wool uniforms. That kind of perhaps contributed to the end of his career. He had an injury. He played 12 seasons with the Yankees and then later went on to be a coach for another 8 or 9 seasons. But in his final year, in 34, they were playing in St. Louis, and it was hot. And think about wearing a wool uniform and an undershirt and all this stuff.
Oh,
and it's the summertime, and it's humid, and you're in St. Louis. Well, he had a collision with the outfield fence, and clearly it was a brick or a concrete fence, and there was no warning track. So he had a skull fracture and a broken shoulder, and that certainly shortened his career. You know, he recovered from that, played a couple more seasons, and finished his career obviously with the Yankees as a player, and then as a beyond that as a coach, and then after he left the Yankees, he spent a couple more years with a couple. He went to Boston. Yeah, that was a unique thing. He went to Boston as a coach. So even the rivalry at that time between Boston and New York was still very strong. Certainly the Yankees having the majority of the success, but it was always unique that he went to Boston. And you know, my dad had the occasion to be up there one time, and Ted Williams is around, and Ted Williams goes to my dad, you know, you're Earl Combs' son. And my dad said, yes, of course I am. He goes, you know, your dad, you know, I didn't like him one bit. As a matter of fact, I loved him. You know, so he really was complimentary of my grandfather.
Oh, that's great. You know, in reading up on the injury, he was hospitalized for a couple of months. And then, and of course, when he did come back, like you said, it really slowed him to the point where he knew when it was time to hang it up. But he also knew, though, that the Yankees were bringing up a rookie center fielder named Joe DiMaggio. So I think he kind of...
That's right. He, to my grandfather's credit, he made that transition, and he helped groom Joe DiMaggio into that position, and it worked out great. If you think about it, Dick, from the early 20s, think about who's played center field for the Yankees.
Oh, my gosh.
Going back to my grandfather,
all
right?
Yep.
And then after him comes, you know, Joe DiMaggio.
That's right.
And then not long after that comes Mickey Mantle.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So, you know, in that period of time from the early 20s through the late 60s, you've got three guys, all Hall of Famers in their own right, you know, as part of one dynamic outfield.
And as I was growing up after Mickey Mantle retired, every center fielder was compared to those guys, and it wasn't fair. Bobby Mercer was going to be the next, you know, all that stuff. So I think that's one of the greatest positional runs, maybe the greatest in the history of Major League Baseball. And I'm reading a quote from Babe Ruth that said, Combs was more than a good ball player. He was always a first-class gentleman. That's got to make you feel good as a family.
Oh, most definitely. He was indeed quite the Kentucky gentleman and Kentucky colonel, and highly respected, and had a successful career, as a leader as a regent at the Eastern Kentucky University, and certainly served as a political appointee of Governor Chandler as the Commissioner of Banking. So they clearly had a friendship, and not only through baseball, but as a fellow Kentuckian, you know, my grandfather was a supporter of Governor Chandler.
Sure, yeah. Well, Don, I really appreciate your time. Again, congratulations to you and your family. And I got a chance a couple years ago to interview the grandson of Branch Rickey. So I just love talking to you folks who have the familial connections to great baseball history. It's so much fun. But I thank you for your time, and hope to meet you maybe over at the ballpark someday.
That sounds great, Dick. Thank you very much for having me on tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. That's Don Combs, who is the grandson of the great Earl Combs. And if you care at all about baseball, get on Wikipedia, Google the name Earl Combs, Earl with an E. Just a phenomenal story of a guy who came from Owsley County, Kentucky, and became literally one of the greatest players in the history of the game. And he did it because he knew he could make more money than the $37 a month he was going to make as a teacher in Owsley County. Now, that's what we pay Curtis, $37 a month, so I expect Curtis to try his hand at pro baseball at some point. And we'll miss you, Curtis, but if you have a Hall of Fame career, we'll certainly understand. Back in just a minute here on 630 WLAP.
Now, when I lived old Kentucky, Linda kissed me and she cried. I told her that I would not linger, that I'd be back by and by.
Well, and Earl Combs came back.
You know what makes that full circle? We got a tweet, me and you, from our buddy Clay Mason yesterday about Willis and Hawkins being in Eastern Kentucky, and they were spotted at Spencer's, which I'm familiar with, is in Owsley County in Boonville because my dad's from there.
Oh, that's right.
And he owns his home place. And Earl Combs has a giant picture on the courthouse in the town.
Are you serious?
Town square, yeah. When you enter Boonville, Earl Combs is right in front of you.
That's awesome. That's very cool. I've been through Boonville, but I've never spent much time there. That is worth stopping in Boonville to find that. That's outstanding. Well, we appreciated Don's knowledge, and again, it's such a great story, and I love stuff like that. But, you know, everybody's got to be from somewhere, obviously, but the fact that Earl Combs came from little old Owsley County and became one of the greatest players in the history of the game, certainly, obviously, something to be proud of. And you can be proud of Derek Willis and Dom Hawkins as well, Kentuckians who had a great time playing for the Wildcats. If you missed it earlier, Curtis got a great comment from Derek Willis.
Yeah, I asked him if he'd had any kind of crazy incidents with the fans during his signing tour, and here was his answer.
I had about a 90-some-year-old lady come up to me, and she was a sweet lady and all that stuff, and she had gotten posters, whatever, I signed her posters, and then she was like, well, can you sign here? And then she pointed to her chest, and I was like, oh, lady, I don't know, and she was like, it would mean a lot to me, and I was like, I kind of just bit the bullet, and you know, I signed her shirt, and then she tried to give me a kiss, and I was like, oh, man, I can't have that. So she tried to kiss me, like, right near the lips, and I ended up, like, moving my head over, and she kissed me on the neck. But, she's a sweet lady, but I couldn't have that lip action.
I couldn't have that lip action. Jennifer Palumbo tweeted at me and said she hoped that the fiancé was listening to that. But, oh, my gosh, that's funny. And you know what? When he said, can you sign this? And when he said, you knew exactly what he was going for, didn't you?
Yeah.
I didn't want to go there in my mind, but we went there in our minds, didn't we?
How can you not help it? I mean, we've all heard stories of rockers signing stuff like that. And the basketball players at UK are rock stars in this state.
That's true. Now, and in all fairness, you wonder, Derek's a young guy. Was she really 90-something? Maybe she seemed 90-something, but anything's possible in the Big Blue Nation. Thanks again to Derek, to Don Combs. For Curtis, I'm Dick Gabriel. That's it. Good night from Lexington.
So she tried to kiss me like right near the lips, and ended up I ended up like leaning my head over, and she kissed me on the neck. But nah, she's a sweet lady, guys. I couldn't have that lip action.